Hello and welcome to a new episode in New Books in Islamic Studies. I'm your host, Sher Ali Tariq. For each new episode, we choose an important new book in the field of Islamic studies and we chat with its author. There are few concepts commonly associated with Islam and Muslims today that evoke more anxiety, phobia, and paranoia than the veil, commonly translated as the hijab. Seen by many as the most quintessential symbol of the alleged Muslim oppression of women, the veil has for some time represented a subject of tremendous rage, debate, polemics, and fantastical stereotypes. But what is the veil? What is its history? Is the veil primarily an Islamic concept and object? What are some of the problems associated with reducing the veil to religion? What is the genealogy of sensationalized representations of the veil in Western popular discourse and media? These are among the questions addressed by Sahar Amr, Professor of Arabic and Islamic Studies at Sydney University in Australia, in her brilliant new book, What is Veiling?, published by the University of North Carolina Press in 2014. Remarkably nuanced and thoughtful, this timely book takes readers on a riveting intellectual journey that brings into focus the complexities of the veil as a discursive, political, and material object. Amr moves seamlessly between multiple texts and contexts, while showing the diversity of ways in which Muslims and non-Muslims have approached, contested, embraced, or resisted the veil in different historical conjunctures. Just as there is no one Islamic position on the veil, there is no one or predetermined meaning that the veil or veiling carries, Amr argues. Puncturing essentialist and stereotypical narratives about the veil, Amr convincingly argues that while seemingly a purely sartorial object, the discourse on the veil is in fact invested in and embroidered by a multiplicity of normative commitments, hopes, fears, and anxieties, irreducible to any singular history, text, religion, or motivation. Beautifully written and exhaustively researched, this book is a must-read for novices and experts alike. A helpful summary of the argument after each chapter should prove particularly useful in the undergraduate classroom. In our conversation, we talked about the history of the veil, discussions on the veil in major normative Muslim textual traditions, progressive Muslim reinterpretations of the veil in Islam, the veil and Orientalism, competing imaginaries of the veil in Europe and the US today, Islamic fashion, and resistance to conservative understandings of the veil in contemporary art and poetry. Here now is my conversation with Professor Sahar Amr. Hello, Sahar. How are you doing?
Hi. How are you, Sher Ali?
Very good. Thank you so much for your time, Sahar. As I was saying to you before we went live, it was such a pleasure reading your book. It is really, one really goes through an arcade of different texts and contexts and historical conditions, material conditions, and just a number of actors and the complexity with which you have dealt with this very timely and difficult question of veiling and the veil is really remarkable. So thank you so much for this intellectual opportunity to engage with you as a reader and now as part of this conversation.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
So we have a tradition in New Books in Islamic Studies that our first question is always biographical. And I can phrase this question as a two-part question. One would be, how did you first become interested in, or how? What is the story behind your becoming interested in and entering the field of Islamic studies and the study of Muslim societies? And then the second part of the question would be, how did you come to write this particular book?
Well, to answer the first question, I have always been interested in the study of Islam and Muslim societies, perhaps for the simple reason that I myself am Egyptian, I'm Muslim, I was born and I grew up in Egypt, and so I have a very personal relationship to Islam and to Muslim societies. I grew up in France and I grew up in the United States, and while I was especially in the United States, I noticed how much misunderstandings and stereotypes are surrounding Muslims. And I always felt very personally involved and touched by these debates. And I've always wanted to understand more so that I can help others better understand Islam and Muslims. So this is really how I became interested in this topic. About veiling in particular, I have a personal interest in it because I myself was veiled for about 10 months of my life when I was in my early 20s and when I was in college at Bryn Mawr. And it was, and then I, what I decided to take off my veil, I did it for very specific reasons. And that it led me to really want to understand more about Islam and why Muslim women veil. And then it has become just a very important part of my scholarly efforts over the last 15 years. I've been teaching classes on veiling, and I've been doing a lot of outreach activities in the U.S. and now in Sydney on veiling practices and Muslim societies. And so when UNC Press approached me to write this book, I felt I was quite ready, and I was very excited about that opportunity.
Terrific. Thank you so much. So let me begin with a broad question to familiarize readers with the objectives of this book. Could you say what are the major conceptual goals and objectives of this book? What are you trying to do in this book?
My main goal is to let readers, both Muslims and non-Muslims, these are really my target audience, have a deeper and more complex and more nuanced understanding of veiling practices. I want to give them some background in the variety of discourses and dimensions that always play a role in any woman's decision to adopt veiling. I wanted to talk about the Quran, but I also wanted to talk about many other facets of veiling that oftentimes people don't think about, such as the political discourse, the social aspect of veiling, the fashion, the poetry, the literature about veiling. So I just wanted to show how multi-layered this is in order to dispel the myth that Islam is the one that invented veiling, or that the Quran requires veiling in clear terms, or that women who are veiled are oppressed and submissive, or that there is one correct way of veiling. And so all of these myths are really what I was trying to challenge throughout writing this book.
So before we discuss the question of what is veiling, which is the title of this book, let us discuss a bit the question of what is the veil and what is the history of the veil. Can you say a bit about the history of the veil and different ways in which we might translate the veil, the different ways in which we might approach the question of what the veil is?
The most important thing that I think that we need to remember when thinking about veiling is that Islam did not invent the veil. And in fact, this is the first sentence of my book, because I think it's really important in today's society when we think about veiling, and when I ask my students what veiling means to them, they immediately think about Muslim women. And veiling existed since 12,000 BC, and it was a social injunction to distinguish aristocratic and married women from lower class prostitutes and unmarried women. So veiling has had, in historical terms, a social meaning before it even acquired a religious meaning. And so this is one important element. The other thing is that, of course, we need to remember that Islam came into a world regions where, well before it, Jews and Christian, Jewish and Christian women were already wearing the veil. In fact, all Mediterranean cultures had women who covered their hair. So I think it's really important to see the veiling in Islam in this kind of larger historical and social and regional context, and not just simply think that Islam just suddenly invented a way of dressing that just nobody had ever heard of.
In the first chapter of your book, you show through a very detailed and nuanced analysis, and you make the case very convincingly that there is no one position in Islam on the question of veiling. There is no such thing as the Islamic position on veiling. Could you explain a bit how and in what ways the subject of veiling is taken up and discussed in major Muslim normative traditions and major Muslim normative texts?
Yes. I think that this is a very important way, I think, for me to start the book, because a lot of Muslims and a lot of non-Muslims actually believe that the Quran, so the major text of Islam, is requiring veiling in clear, explicit, and in no uncertain terms. And that is actually very questionable belief. And so my first chapter is precisely to go through all of the major surahs in the Quran that most Muslims cite in order to justify their understanding and their practice that veiling is actually part of Islam. And through my research and through other scholars' research, it's very clear that the Quran, when it speaks about veiling, it actually does not use the term hijab, which is today the most common equivalent to the term veiling in English, even though that's really not a very accurate translation, but that's what is used today. So the word hijab is actually very rarely used in the Quran to address women at all. And when it is speaking about women, it's speaking more about the screen that serves to distinguish or to protect the privacy of the Prophet's wives from men. And even in that verse in Quran 33:53, the responsibility of maintaining this hijab, this privacy of the Prophet's wife, is actually put on men and not on women. So this is quite interesting because, of course, it reverses our belief or the tradition that Muslim women are the ones who are responsible for maintaining hijab. And then in other verses in the Quran that speaks about women's clothing, the word hijab is not used. And in fact, it's very it's talking more in much more general terms about the need to be modest, to cover the woman's ornament, to draw the scarves over the necklines, and to cover the woman's beauty. And so this, of course, is not so clear what is the woman's ornament, what is the woman's beauty, and who gets to decide whether a woman is beautiful and needs to cover herself or not. And so the Quran is much more open-ended than people assume that it is. And it's only exegetical interpretation of the Quran that were developed several centuries after the Quran came into being. So Al-Tabari, for example, Al-Razi or Ibn al-Jawzi, so in the 10th through the 13th century, that layers of interpretations have been superimposed on the Quran that have become more and more restrictive, interpreting the very open-ended verses of the Quran in a very specific way, saying that the woman's body is the ornament that needs to be covered, and the only disagreements that exegetical writers had was whether the woman's face and hands had to be covered or not.
In the next chapter of your book, you discuss progressive Muslims and their attempts at rethinking the question of veiling in Islam. So who are progressive Muslims, and what are some of the discursive and hermeneutical strategies through which they have tried and sought to rethink veiling and the question of veiling in Islam?
Progressive Muslims are Muslims throughout the world, in both Muslim majority and Muslim minority societies, who are trying to re-engage in a much more personal and spiritual way with the texts of the Quran and with the history of Islam, in order to, with the main goal of upholding and reconnecting with the spirit of equality and diversity that exists in the message of Islam. And so for them, it's really important to reread the Quran and to peel away the layers of exegetical meanings that have been superimposed on the holy texts over the centuries and reinterpret those texts in a new, more equitable and more spiritual way. So the progressive Muslims are basically rereading the Quran, they are rereading the Hadith, they are rereading the development of jurisprudence, and try to try to reinterpret or research the terms that are used in the Quran to speak about women's dress. So, for example, the jilbab or the khimar or the awra. What are all of these terms mean? And specifically, what did they mean in the 7th century? And so by exploring this meaning, by digging back into Islamic history, by exploring the role that Muslim women have played in the early days of Islam and throughout Islamic history, those progressive Muslims are able to give us a completely new way of reading the Quran, of reading Hadith, of reading jurisprudence, and also, of course, of understanding veiling practices.
You convincingly and brilliantly show in this book that just as veiling cannot be reduced to the Quran, it can also not be reduced as a solely religious practice, which seems to be one of the major misconceptions or stereotypes about veiling. So if we were to think about the practice of veiling, for instance, in Muslim-majority contexts, what are some of the major political, legal, and cultural factors that we should be attentive to in order to develop a more nuanced, a more multi-layered understanding of veiling as a practice and the veil?
I think that it's really important to look at veiling historically and contextually. And so if one looks at veiling even just throughout the 20th century, so not even going any further than that, in the 20th century, in most Muslim majority societies, women had stopped wearing the veil. And so when you look, for example, in Turkey, Turkey, starting with Atatürk in the 1920s, had a very important movement to westernize and Europeanize the society in order to advance Turkish culture. So Atatürk had a number of reforms, most notably what is known as the hat law. And of course, he was more interested in men than in women. And so he wanted men to change their way of dressing in order to imitate European clothing, and so therefore no longer wear the fez, the traditional hat, but wear more European or American style hats. But he also encouraged, and then later there was a particular law that developed in Turkey, encouraged also Turkish women to behave and to dress and to act in ways very more similar to European women. And so veiling became very discouraged in the 1980s in Turkey. A lot of Turkish women were no longer allowed to go to the university, for example, if they were veiled. They could no longer have government jobs if they were veiled. And it's only really in the last year or two that there has been many changes in Turkish laws that allow veiled Turkish women to attend university, for example, or to have government jobs. So I think that, therefore, we see that really it's not Islam or it's not religion that determines whether a woman is veiling or not. In this particular case, and there are many cases, we can talk about Iran, we can talk about Indonesia. I mean, there are many different examples that one could give that show that it's actually politics that here determine primarily whether a woman is going to be allowed to veil or not to veil.
Now, one of the things that I really liked about this book was that you clearly showed that the stereotypes and the sensationalized narratives about the veil that we find in our midst today, they have histories, that there are genealogies of these present-day representations of the veil. So what are some of these varied and at times diverging fantasies about the veil that you talk about, and about Muslim women's bodies found in 19th and early 20th century European popular discourses or Orientalist discourses? And what are the sorts of media that were being employed and used to disseminate and to project these sorts of fantasies about the veil and about the female Muslim body?
It's very interesting how before 9/11, When I asked my students what came to mind when they thought about veiling, they didn't give the image that now is prevalent, which is the woman is oppressed or somebody's forcing her to veil or something like that. The images that came to mind for them was more of Aladdin, Jasmine. So the idea of this very orientalist perspective of erotic, sexually available Muslim women. And these ideas developed really from the middle of the 18th century and throughout the 19th and early 20th century, in which we have an entire discourse produced by European politicians, diplomats, artists, novelists, travel writers, photographers, I mean, you name it, everybody in terms of high culture and then quickly popular culture like postcards, for example, or advertisement, quickly adopted that very same perspective of the Muslim women as an erotic creature, lounging in harems full of women, awaiting either some sexual meeting with a white man or awaiting also their liberation by brown men, to use a very famous phrase here. And this whole discourse of Orientalism of the sexually available woman and also the oppressed woman who is held up in a harem and by a very nasty husband or father, is really the parallel the parallel of the military incursions that was taking place at the same time. In other words, European colonizers were seeking a cultural way of justifying their military incursions by showing that they're actually seeking to civilize those Muslim societies and liberate those women from their oppression. And of course, in the same time, having a lot of sexual possibilities with them. And so the veiling that we see today as an oppression of women, actually for many Muslim evokes also that very big history of imperialism that is still very much alive in Muslim societies today.
So in the next two chapters of your book, you shift the geographic focus a bit from Muslim majority contexts to discussing discourses and representations of the veil in Western Europe and in the U.S. in the contemporary moment. And I was wondering if we could perhaps engage in a discussion which is comparative in nature, comparing, you know, Western Europe and the U.S. today. So what, Sahar, would you say are some of the major similarities and differences in how the veil is viewed in Europe and the U.S. today, and in how Muslim women in these two contexts have had to contend with or negotiate the dominant political and popular discourses on the veil that they see and find in their midst?
Well, I think that perhaps the main similarity between Western Europe and the U.S. is the fact that Muslim women are always at the forefront of any discourse about Islam and about veiling. And they are oftentimes bearing the brunt of any policies that are made in the name of stopping the global war on terror or on in the name of national security. So I would say that it's basically they become the victim of all of these political discourses in both regions of the world. Now, the history of the politics towards veiling in both societies are actually quite different. In Europe and in France in particular, and I use France as a case study of what happens in Europe because it seems to always be the leader in any types of laws towards Muslim immigrants because, or Muslim, they're not immigrants, they're actually citizens of those European nations, but they're always spoken about as if they were immigrants. And so France really seems to be the leader in any policies that is made, and whenever there is a law in France that happens, then it seems to be adopted then very quickly by other societies. I think in France, the one thing that one needs to really understand is that their notion of the republic is very different from any notion in the US. And so for France to be a citizen means to shed all differences and all ethnic, religious, linguistic, and cultural differences in order to become a neutral citizen. And so in France, they are very much against the notion of multiculturalism because everybody needs to be made French. So if you decide to wear the veil, then you're going to look different. And so for France, by looking different, you are claiming a special status, which for them defeats the whole purpose of the republic and of being a citizen. And so the notion of laïcité or secularism, that's how it's translated, even though it's not exactly the same thing. But that notion of secularism in France just means the rejection of any sort of multiculturalism, any sort of affirmative action. And so France adopted a law in 2004 that bans girls from wearing hijab in public schools. And then in 2010, France became the second country after Belgium to ban the full body burqa and niqab from all public spaces. And so public spaces means from the streets, from gardens, from the shopping malls, from, of course, government buildings. In other words, from anywhere. And so, and this was made in France in the name, again, at the beginning of upholding secularism, so the French notion of the republic. But then the discourse starting in the 2004-2005 became a discourse of liberating Muslim women, so a feminist discourse. And it's through that feminist discourse that really France was able to get more popular support for the policies that were made. And of course, those policies are very I think disappointing because they're now also being adopted by the majority of European societies. So that's the situation in Europe. In the United States, of course, the notion of multiculturalism is really very important and fundamental to American, the American Constitution and American history. So there is no law that is made against wearing hijab or niqab. And I don't think there could be a law really that would pass there. At least I hope not. But despite the fact that there is no laws, there is still a lot of discrimination against women and girls who are wearing the hijab. And we see those discrimination particularly in the workplace, for example. A lot of women are not able to get jobs because they wear hijab. And a lot of girls, for example, are not able to participate in sports, in organized sports from their schools because they wear hijab. There's a lot of discrimination in the pool, for example, because of either the way the girl themselves dress or because of the mother who is accompanying the children is dressed. So we see those kind of discrimination in much different type of location. There is no general law about it, but it seems to be pervasive throughout American societies, those other types of discrimination that are become particularly vehement as soon as there is an international crisis that then a lot of people take as justifying further discrimination against Muslim women. The only place where I think that there is a more political discrimination against women in the U.S. Could be seen in the place, for example, of getting a driver's license. So interestingly, before 2011, there were some states in the U.S. that allowed a woman to have a driver's license without a picture affixed to it. And of course, this all changed after 9/11, in which, you know, women have to have a picture and they do not allow a woman wearing a face veil to have that picture on her driver's license. So there is still, you know, still discrimination, but it doesn't seem to have the kind of political and mediatic attention that all of these discussions have in Europe.
One of the topics that you discuss extensively in your book is that of Muslim feminist understandings and approaches towards veiling in Islam. And you show something very curious in this chapter and something very fascinating, that Muslim feminist expressions in relation to veiling could either represent a rejection of veiling or an embrace of veiling. It can go both ways in interesting ways. So how have Muslim feminist understandings and approaches towards veiling transformed over the last 100 years? And how can embracing or rejecting the veil both represent particular expressions of feminism?
I think veiling and feminism is a really important topic to consider, because for a lot of people, these two words happening in the same sentence are assumed to be an oxymoron. How could you be veiled and covered and also claim to be a feminist? And I think that this kind of idea perhaps stems from first world, the first wave feminism in Europe and in the US, which highlighted the fact that the more clothing you wear, the more oppressed you are, and the less clothing you wear, you're more liberated you are. And this really just doesn't work at all in the context of Muslim societies and of feminism and veiling. There has always been two lines of argument in feminism in Muslim societies in relation to women's clothing throughout the 20th century. And both of them existed from the beginning of the 20th century, but they had different weights and different emphasis. So in the early 20th century, the loudest voice that one could hear is the voice of Egyptian feminism, Qasem Amin, who was actually a man, and Hoda Sharawi, a woman. And Hoda Sharawi's 1923 very famous appearance in Egypt upon her return from a big international conference on women in Italy, when she appeared without her veil. And of course, without the veil at that time just meant without her face veil. She kept her head covered for another several years before that being shed. And in that discourse of Qasem Amin and Hoda Sharawi, lifting the veil, so uncovering the face, was a huge, huge step in demanding the liberation of women and their work side by side with men. That type of feminism, so uncovering because as a means to achieving feminism, resembled and recalled a lot of the colonial discourse of the time, which also sought to liberate Muslim women by uncovering them. And so a lot of people have always said Huda Sharawi is actually repeating just the colonial perspective. And in a way, it's true, but we also have to remember that Huda Sharawi was a very staunch anti-colonialist. She was also fighting against British occupation of Egypt. So it was very possible that some of her ideas resembled the colonial perspective, but she wasn't herself a colonialist. So there was like this voice, so uncovering liberation. But then at the same time, and a voice by Malek Hifni Nassif, who was also another feminist from the 1920s, she actually felt that it was not a good idea to shed the veil. And for her, it was because that's precisely also what the British wanted. But it was important to keep women veiled, because for her, the main problem was not the veil, but the main problem was women's education. And so she wanted to emphasize women's education and then let them choose whether they want to veil or not to veil. And so here, again, another voice of feminism that's saying that veiling is not an issue. What is more important is education and choice. And this voice is actually the voice that was very that was not heard very much in the early 20th century, but that since the 1980s across Muslim majority societies has become the main voice of feminism, of Islamic feminism, which is, again, education, work, socioeconomic independence, and then choosing whether or not to veil.
In the last section of your book, you take up the topic of how conservative or essentialist understandings of the veil are challenged and resisted through non-textual or alternative media like fashion and poetry and art. And really, we can spend an entire interview on either of these chapters in many ways. We could have an entire interview on Islamic fashion, for example. That was such a fascinating chapter. But I was wondering if you could highlight some of the ways in which conservative or essentialist interpretations of Islamic veiling are being or have been resisted through these media like fashion, poetry, and art.
Yeah, it's very interesting how fashion, which has become like a multi-million dollar industry in the last perhaps 20 or 25 years, is really both maintaining Islamic practices and challenging Islamic practices. And that's because today it's not uncommon at all to see everywhere around the world, Muslim women dressed not just in the black abaya and the black scarf, which is the traditional way we think about veiling, but in a lot of vibrant colors and vibrant styles, and that change with the seasons. Every time I go to Egypt or that I travel in Muslim majority societies, I'm always amazed by the new styles that the scarf is dyed, by the new abaya styles, the embroidery, the precious stones that a lot of Muslim women like to adopt. And so I think that fashion can provide a space in which women individualize their own clothing, just like a woman who is not veiled also individualizes herself and shows her independence by the selection of clothing that she is making. So I think that there is a big space for women to really explore and adapt and adopt whatever it is that they want to wear and assert their cosmopolitanism, their modernity, their agency in the world. There's also a whole other discourse of poetry and art that seeks to also challenge conservative views of veiling and give another voice in which we can explore veiling practices through other media. So in poetry, I really like the poems by Mohja Kahf, for example, who talks about how veiling is really something that people have a lot of assumptions about, but that actually can be, but they actually reveal women's independence and women's individuality, and that it's much more important to see the mind of women and to see their creativity and their personality and their intelligence instead of focusing on this very visible sign, but that doesn't have that doesn't tell us much about women themselves. And then I love art. And so to me, art was a natural space in which to look for alternative views of veiling. And we have so many different artists today, both men and women, who address the topic of veiling. And in fact, I could have probably written an entire book just on art and veiling. And I had to make a very small selection in my book. And there are artists who, for example, try to show how women, let the viewer experience women's let the viewer experience what goes on in the mind of women who are veiled. I'm thinking here of Khalida Bougriet, who has done a beautiful video called Les Illuminés, the Enlightened One. And basically she put a camera inside the burqa of a woman and is filming from inside the burqa what the woman is seeing as she is walking through the metro station in Paris. And so, of course, here we see what the woman is seeing, and we also see how other people are looking at this woman, whom they don't know, is also filming their reaction. So here, very interesting to see a perspective from both sides. So the woman inside, who seems to be oppressed because the whole video is showing the bars that presumably cover her eyes. And so we assume that she is very oppressed. But then when we see how others are looking back at her and the fear that is in their eyes, their shock, the ignorance, the stereotypes that to which she is subjected daily, so we see what she is living through every day. But in the end, we also realize that the person here who is actually in charge of the entire scene is the woman who is in burqa, not the people who are looking at her, because we see everything through her eyes. So it's a very empowering video, even though it starts as though it was going to be a very disempowering type of artistic expression.
So, Sahar, in your opinion, what are the kinds of spaces and opportunities or possibilities for resistance that are opened up by these alternative modes of expression, like fashion, poetry, and art, that may not be available through, somewhat more conventional reinterpretations of religious texts, for example, canonical texts, the Quran, and so forth. How are these projects of reinterpretation similar and different, and what kinds of possibilities and spaces do you think these forms of expression open up for this project of rethinking the question of veiling in Islam and so on?
I think that the question of fashion, poetry, and art, for example, speaks to different people. I think that there's a big, I'm hoping that my audience for this book is both scholarly, but also the general audience and students in classes. And for students, for example, when I teach my class on veiling, they connect a lot more quickly to the main issues on veiling when we talk on fashion, poetry, and art. And that might be a generational thing, or these are issues that they are interested in. They like art, they like poetry, they like fashion. And so you can talk to them about it and through that allow them to better understand the more religious or political discourse about veiling. So I think that it's really also just important for people to realize that basically we do a disservice to the whole topic of Islam or Muslim women and veiling practices if we only limit the discussion to politics and religion. I mean, these are important. There are many other things that Muslim women that are part of the experience of Muslim women that we must take into account if we are really going to understand veiling from their perspective and hear their voices.
Well, as we're approaching the end of our time here, Sahar, I was wondering if you could share with our listeners what are the kinds of things you're working on these days and what are some of the things that we can anticipate and expect to read from you and learn from your work in the coming months and years, I guess?
Yes. Well, I'm right now I'm actually working on questions of gender and sexuality in Muslim societies, and particularly looking at LGBTIQ communities in contemporary Arab societies. And I'm also exploring how Islam and homosexuality are negotiated in these communities, particularly when we are when it is the case of veiled Muslim women who are also dealing with alternative sexual experiences. So this is another extremely sensitive topic. It's a bit difficult to explore because I have to maintain the privacy of the people that I'm working with. But I think this is another way one can change some of the conservative reading of Islam and also some of the stereotype that both Muslims and non-Muslims have about Muslim communities.
What is Veiling by Sahar Amar? Published by the University of North Carolina Press in 2014. Thank you so much, Sahar, for your time. It was such a pleasure to read your book and a delight to talk to you about it today. So thank you so much for this book, for this wonderful and outstanding book, and for your time today and for being a part of New Books in Islamic Studies.
Thank you, Sharad.
So this was my conversation with Professor Sahar Amar about her new book, What is Veiling? Thank you so much for listening. Please join us next time for another episode of New Books in Islamic Studies. Until then, This is your host, Sher Ali Tareen, signing off. Take care and stay well.